You dirty little fools, what's going on? This is the QTR Podcast. I'm going to remind you, as I always do, that today's podcast is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign up through Patreon and donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast. I appreciate the shit out of all you guys. I'm going to shout out my patrons. I'm going to give you the two rules of the podcast, and then we're going to get on our damn way. How about that? First and foremost, I want to thank my friends over at the Sanlucci Steam Room. The Sanlucci Steam Room is the best place if you are a trader to get information on big money coming into the options market. Folks, you sit in the Steam Room, you wait to see where the money is coming into the options market, and then you can make a decision on whether or not the equity or the underlying in freaky Wall Street Dutch is worth possibly investing in. Or maybe you want to be a degenerate and chase the options flow. I don't know, folks. What goes on at your own house is nobody's business but your own. But nobody points out big money coming into the options market quite like Sanlucci. He's been doing it with his partner, Charlie Bathgate, for a decade. These guys are experts. And in addition to the Steam Room, Lucci has links in my podcast for one, the Sanlucci Master Course, which is an educational trader course that is run by Lucci himself, and two, the 3LT playbook. If you're not down for a home master course, what are the three simple rules Lucci has used to turn himself into a seven-figure trader? I've seen the P&L, I've seen the bank statements. He's not full of shit. He is a friend of mine. I trust him. I like him. Check out the 3LT playbook. Check out my homeboys over at Sanlucci. This podcast is also brought to you by my very dear friends over at The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is a brand new service for day traders that is creating a community around day trading. So many services you sign up for, they front run your trades, they treat you like a piece of shit. You don't get to talk to, you know, the guy that runs the service touts his P&L. Nobody on the service does very well. The Trader's Path was created to do something different for day traders. My man Pete over there got tired of that same old bullshit nonsense, so he started his own shit. What does he do? He trades in green markets. He trades in red markets. He trades options. He trades stocks. He's going to give daily watch lists. They have a community that shares ideas. They have a live stream that goes on all day. Live stream is the word I'm looking for. Folks, I'm still learning how to speak English. Please bear with me. They have a live stream every day, and they also offer investor advocacy, investor education. They don't mess around with frauds. They don't mess around with low float garbage. These guys are the real deal. Check out my dear friends over at The Trader's Path. Also, this podcast is brought to you by my friends at Rumorhound. Folks, Rumorhound has the only product of its kind if you're a trader. What do they have? They have an AI-based piece of software that is going to take a look at merger and acquisition rumors that pop up on the daily, on television, on Twitter, in your chat rooms, and generally within the trading universe. And they are going to take that rumor, put that into the blender with their proprietary variables and algorithm and all kinds of artificial intelligence shit that I wouldn't understand if I lived to be 265 years old. They put the button on go. Everything spins around and the algorithm spits out to you based on these proprietary variables whether or not this merger and acquisition rumor is something you should maybe pay attention to, lend some credence to, maybe deploy some capital to. Of course, we don't recommend investment decisions on this show, but Rumorhound might be able to keep you well informed and better informed on these rumors. Ignore the ones that are bullshit. Go after the ones that you think have some steam to them. Rumorhound is going to be a great tool in your toolbox to help you do that, especially if you are a day trader, if you are an active trader. All of the links to Rumorhound are in the podcast description. You can check them out at rumorhound.ai. I've seen the software. Not only is it functional, but it's actually quite nice to look at as well. I want to thank my friends at Rumorhound for continuing to support the podcast. And if you guys like what I do, please help support my patrons and then become a patron yourself. I also want to shout out some of my other notable patrons like my friends at Corvus Gold, my friend Monero, shipping analyst Jay Mintzmeyer, Russ Valenti, Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud at Traders for a Cause and Investors Underground, Chris Bede, Ken R., Chris Boas, my friend Crichton Titus, Ken, J.K. Cunningham and Stank Love, Brainerd Ferguson, I see you too, and some of my newest patrons since the last podcast. Then we're going to get started, folks. I swear to God. Bear with me right here while this stupid thing loads. Come on, you pile of shit. Here it is. Egg Nasty, Charles Magnin, thank you, my brother. Justin Roberts, Michael Johnson, and Chris Wagner. And some of my older patrons that have been with me, like Louis J. Desi Jr., thank you, my friend. Daniel Rust, Money Lobster is still with me. I see you on Twitter. OUGrad05, thank you, my friend. Mihailo Heiler and Mark Woolard. Okay. Actually, Mark Woolard got off the list, but I'm thanking you anyways for once being a patron, Mark. Now, you're no longer with us. But how about my buddy Santo? And I know him because he shouts me out on Twitter, too. I haven't said what's up to him in a while. Two rules for the podcast upcoming. First and foremost, folks, on every single podcast, I recommend a two-drink minimum. How it happens is you put two drinks down in front of you, then you put them into your mouth, then you swallow, then you smile, and you listen. Everybody's happy. You rate me 5 stars on iTunes. You subscribe on YouTube. You may regret the decisions you make the next day, folks, but it's a momentary gratification for you and a lifetime of gratification for me. So everybody wins. Drink up and make the wrong decisions. And also, this podcast is not life advice, investment advice. I'm not a journalist. I'm not a financial advisor. Everything we say here, we say it with an open mind. We're just getting this shit out there, folks. You can take what you like and you can leave what you don't like. But why don't we get the goddamn show started, huh? Today, I am very happy to have with me David Meiswinkle and Mick Harrison, who are two gentlemen working for a group called Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. Mick Harrison is the director of litigation. He's a public interest attorney, graduate summa cum laude of the University of the District of Columbia School of Law. He has a national practice focused on cases that involve whistleblower protection, government accountability, corporate fraud and false claims in dangers to public health or the environment. And geez, we like that on this show, especially all of my fellow short sellers and fraud hunters. In addition, I have Mr. David Meiswinkle. He's the president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. The group is a nonprofit corporation dedicated to transparency and accountability related to 9/11. David is a licensed attorney in New Jersey since 1989, and for the past 10 years, he has been a criminal defense attorney. He's also a former New Jersey police officer with 23 years experience and a United States Army veteran stationed in Germany, where he worked with the Pershing nuclear missiles and was a pace setter for a champion marching team, which marched 25 miles with 25-pound packs. Wow. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome both of you guys to the show. How are you today, guys?
Good. Thanks, Chris.
Very good, Chris. Thank you.
All right. Wonderful. So here's where I'd like to start things with you guys. And we can pretty much take this from the top for a couple of reasons. I'm still getting familiar with your organization and what you guys are doing. And I'm certain that many of my listeners don't know what you guys are doing. We've had Richard Gage on the show a couple of times, and we've spoken to him certainly about what he thinks about 9/11. Many of my listeners still have many unanswered questions. Talk to me a little bit about your group. I guess David would probably be the best to lead with this. Tell us about your group and where you guys fall in this whole, in the whole 9/11 universe right now.
Right. Thank you, Chris. Well, you mentioned Richard Gage, and he's a pivotal person in the 9/11 truth movement and the architects and engineers. They've done the yeoman work for the last at least 10 years, and they were able to gather a lot of evidence. What we like to say as lawyers is dispositive or conclusive of controlled demolition, bombs, explosions, incendiaries that were used to bring the World Trade Centers down. And they have the science to back it up. As I said, they've been around for a number of years, but it took someone like the Lawyers Committee to legally gather that evidence and put it in a legal frame, a structure, and present it to a U.S. attorney for presentation to a grand jury. So that's what basically we were able to do last year. And both Mick and I can elaborate further on that. But as far as architects and engineers, their primary interest is New York City, Ground Zero. And to yourself and your audience, that if you recall that 9/11 crimes involved not just New York City, but there was an incident in Pennsylvania with a United Flight 93, which mysteriously is claimed to have crashed in the country there near Shanksville. And there's also the Pentagon, which was attacked. And those crimes, too, have not been really addressed. So what we're saying in the Lawyers Committee is that, as you mentioned, we're nonprofit, and we have a number of attorneys involved with us. And we have an advisory board of attorneys, too, our advisory committee. And we're both basically under the – all of us under the thinking that a better investigation should have been done. Mm-hmm. And the story that's being told – or told to the public, the historical narrative is not accurate.
For me, it's always important to kind of flesh out things in the spectrum of people that want a new investigation into 9/11. And I'll tell you why, because throughout my, whatever you want to call it, independent research, throughout my, reviewing what has happened on 9/11, of course, living through it and remembering what that day was like and what the media coverage was like that day, and certainly firsthand having a good look over the last two decades on how that has impacted, policy here in the United States and just our world in general around us, there is a broad spectrum of what I would say 9/11 truth theorists, many of which I don't subscribe to. You have the groups out there that say there were no planes when in my opinion, we can very clearly see planes flying into the building. You have groups out there that have already concocted this extraordinarily long, complex, detailed, it was Dick Cheney and he had a remote control and it was this and that and the other thing. And those things I hate to even entertain at all, too, because where I come from and what I've told Mr. Gage is I just come from the stance that there are too many pieces of missing and or circumstantial evidence that all I advocate for is a new investigation. Because to me, when I look at things like Building 7 and I look at, the fact that we don't have a frame of video showing the plane going into the Pentagon and those types of little pockets of air, as I'll call them, that makes me think, man, we should really look into this again. Of course, there's inconsistencies with other things, with the, commission report and all those things. Where do you guys fall on that spectrum? I would think as lawyers, you guys take a very kind of fact-based approach to this.
Well, that's true. We are fact-based, and we're open-minded, as Dave says. We believe there needs to be a new investigation, so we agree with you on that. And we want to follow the evidence wherever it takes us. We're in the middle of some investigations, so for some of these issues, particularly regarding the Pentagon and Shanksville, we don't have a position yet because we haven't completed our own investigation.
Right.
And as you said, the investigations officially to date leave these unanswered questions, which is problematic. But on the Trade Center, as David points out, in terms of the use of explosives, we're further along, thanks to the work of folks like Richard Gage and Kevin Ryan and Niels Herod and Stephen Jones, and we could go down the list. But a lot of those initial questions about, why did those buildings collapse on 9/11 have been answered scientifically, and that evidence, as David says, is dispositive. It doesn't really allow for any other explanation. And so we have adopted a position on that issue because the evidence is sufficient, the evidence in hand is sufficient. But pretty much everything else we're still looking at.
So the position of your group, I'm guessing, is you're not contesting the aircraft, but what you're saying is that both towers and Building 7, so three towers, all came down by controlled demolition. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much. We're not saying there were no aircraft hits on the towers. We're saying that the reason they collapsed,
right,
not the reason they caught on fire, but the reason they collapsed was the use of explosives.
And we're saying, too, also, Chris, that if the audience goes on our website, lc4for911.org, they can look at the grand jury petition that we submitted last year to the U.S. attorney and the exhibits. Right now, there's 60 exhibits. And the first, to begin with, there's 57 exhibits. And those exhibits, for the most part, are dispositive of the controlled demolition and the bombs. Some of the exhibits are scientific studies, seismic studies, studies of the dust, the thermite, and very convincing, 122 firemen that basically talk about bombs and explosions in the building, 155 right. total first responders, in other words, police officers too, and emergency management people that experienced explosions and bombs in the building. And you can imagine if the 9/11 commission, well, you can imagine in a court of law, let's put it this way, what the 9/11 commission didn't do, they didn't call available witnesses to the crime, to the explosions and bombs in the building. So if you are trying to find out what would happen, it would seem that common sense would tell you or to certainly call people that might have a direct link or contact to explaining how those buildings came down. That was never done, never done. And that's one of the exhibits. It's just one exhibit, 125 statements. And in part, those statements were gotten through a Freedom of Information Act by the New York Times, because the fire department, New York City Fire Department, had taken those statements. They were all written down, and but they weren't released. And they forced them to be released. And when they were released, that people studied. And one of the people we know was a doctor, a university professor in Canada, Graham McQueen. He examined all the pages, and he ferreted out with parameters are very strict, those that were talking about bombs and explosions, etc. And we've taken those statements and put them as just one of the exhibits. So if the your audience would like to read those statements as to what the firemen experienced, all they have to do is go on that website I told you, lc4for911.org.
Yeah, and I will. I'll put a link to your website in my podcast description, so my listeners can just click right through. So it's a little bit easier for them. But you know, I think this is really important what you guys are doing, because one of the things that's been bothersome for me over the last couple of decades, and one of the things that's continued to kind of hold my interest in a new investigation, has been all of these pieces of evidence that would be, admissible in court, right? You have all of these firsthand accounts of what happened, what we have on video from the day of what happened, statements from firefighters, with regard to Building 7. Oh, that building's going to come down soon, Oh, there were a group of secondary explosions. There were actual videos where you can hear the secondary explosions. You can hear explosions taking place. And somehow, gentlemen, over the course of the last two decades, it has all kind of just gone into the wash. We were handed a story, and for a while it was so, it's such a visceral thing for people that you couldn't even talk about it. You couldn't even question the story. Yet here was this layer of evidence that told, to me at least, over the last couple of decades, a story that was a little bit different than what we had been told. So I think it's so important the way that you guys are doing this. From a legal standpoint, though, talk about what your group is trying to do. How are you trying to affect change using the law?
Mick, why don't you do that? Mick is our litigation director, so he's best qualified to answer that.
Well, I'll start, and Dave, you can chime in when I'm finished if you wish. We do have several legal actions active at the moment, Chris. We have, to start with, Dave mentioned, we petitioned the U.S. Attorney in New York, Southern District of New York, on the demolition evidence, a detailed petition asking under the federal statute regarding special grand juries that the U.S. Attorney give all this demolition evidence to a special federal grand jury to investigate it, use their subpoena power, and the other powers they have, including the ability to give a witness immunity and develop that evidence, and then, if necessary, indict responsible parties. That petition is pending. The U.S. Attorney did give us a letter, and Dave probably remembers the date. I don't remember the date exactly. I think it was like November, December of 2017, maybe.
Yeah, it was exactly November 7th, 2018.
Okay. So the U.S. Attorney did agree to comply with that federal statute, which requires every U.S. Attorney, when they receive a report of a federal crime from citizens, to relay the report and the evidence to a special grand jury, assuming it's a federal crime, which this is. So our problem with that action, Chris, is that even though it's well-based in fact in law and the U.S. Attorney agreed to comply, we have heard nothing else from the U.S. Attorney, notwithstanding our efforts to inquire about the status. And there's a reason for that. The U.S. Attorney, the assistant U.S. Attorney who spoke with Dave and I about it, said he couldn't tell us anything further because of the secrecy rules regarding grand jury proceedings. And so we don't know yet exactly what the U.S. Attorney has done or not done in terms of giving all the evidence we submitted to a grand jury. Because we're unable to find out the answer to that question, we have filed another action, which is in the U.S. District Court, still in the Southern District of New York. And it's a combination of a mandamus action, which is a legal action to compel a federal official to do a mandatory duty under the law. And it's also a motion for disclosure of grand jury records. And what we're asking, since the U.S. Attorney refuses to tell us anything, and we think that he could tell us more than he has, we know there is some secrecy involved, but what we're looking for in that lawsuit is either that the judge order the U.S. Attorney to simply tell the court and us the status and confirm that our evidence was submitted to a special grand jury, or in the alternative, if a disclosure cannot be ordered or if a disclosure is made and it turns out the U.S. Attorney did not actually submit the evidence, then we want an order from the court that the U.S. Attorney be required to submit our evidence to the grand jury. So that's our second legal action. We have a third legal action, which we had a decision on recently from the U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. This is a lawsuit against the FBI, and it relates to the second 9/11 commission. A lot of folks don't know there was a second 9/11 commission, but it was called the 9/11 Review Commission, and it did its work in 2014-2015. And the Congress had, to its credit, required the FBI to do a review and analysis of all evidence regarding 9/11 that had not been addressed by the original commission. And that mandate came down in 2013 from Congress to the FBI. And the reason we ended up suing the FBI in this is that the FBI and its 9/11 Review Commission ended up essentially ignoring all the significant evidence that came out over the years after 9/11, including all the demolition evidence, didn't even touch it. So we have a suit in the federal court in D.C. We got a decision recently from the district court granting the government's motion to dismiss on standing grounds, which means the court agreed with the government that neither the Lawyers Committee nor the Architects and Engineers, which is our co-plaintiff, nor Robert McElvain, the father of Bobby McElvain, who perished at the Trade Center on 9/11, that none of us had standing to bring a suit to compel the FBI to honor the congressional mandate. So we're in the process of deciding whether to appeal that decision, which I suspect is probable. And we'll let folks know when that moves forward. And we also have three federal lawsuits in Washington, D.C., in the district court there on three different Freedom of Information Act issues where we have requested records regarding 9/11 and been denied by federal agencies access to those records. And the short version of those is that the first, we asked for the building performance study data from FEMA, and which turns out to have been transferred to NIST, the National Institutes of Standards and Technology. And so we're suing both of those agencies because they did not provide that data. And then, or all of it, I should say, they did give us some records. And then we're suing NIST on not providing us certain interviews conducted of witnesses at the Trade Center on 9/11. And we're also suing NIST because they don't want to give us the data regarding Column 79 of Building 7, which is where they say Building 7 collapse started. So short version of a long story. But that's sort of where we're at. We have other things sort of being considered.
In addition to that, too, Chris, that complaint, that action that Mitch just spoke of, had seven counts in it. And those accounts were very important areas of evidence that the FBI was, we believe, mandated by Congress to report on, because it never had been, wasn't known or discussed by the 9/11 Commission when they made their recommendations. And the first count had to do with the controlled demolition evidence in New York City that we talked about, that Richard Gage talked to you about. The second had to do with a group of individuals who were seen videotaping the event as it was happening, apparently set up on the top of a moving van in New Jersey,
right,
and were arrested in New Jersey. And the film was confiscated, and we know that 76 8x10 photographs were printed of that. And certainly it would be interesting to see at what time they began the photograph, to see if they did actually have pre-knowledge of the event.
Right.
And eventually, so that was count two, to get information regarding to that, that evidence of that arrest. There's extensive FBI reports on that. And then the disappearance of evidence, apparently those photos have, at least we've been told, may have been destroyed. The FBI, or through a FOIA request, made that they advised us of that. So account four had to do with Saudi financing, and Mick was instrumental in part in the, getting the 28 pages released. That was had to do with actually these terrorists, the alleged terrorists that came to San Diego, and their connection with various people, including the head ambassador for Saudi Arabia, Bondar, and his wife, Princess Haifa. Apparently they could have been involved with some kind of financing of them, appears at least in the 28 pages, and other aspects of that that were never told to Congress at that time. Count five had to do with Pentagon cameras that the public didn't know about, and
right,
we've never seen any of the films of it, of what possibly hit the Pentagon. Part six had to do with plane parts, in particular serial numbers. Serial numbers are on some of the major parts of a plane. They tell you what plane hit what building.
Sure.
And then point seven, or count seven, had to do with cell phone communications. There was a lot of controversy on the Washington, well, all the flights, as far as the cell phone communications, because at that time, at high altitudes, cell phone communications didn't work above 8,000 feet. There's supposed to be expert reports on that. So some of these calls were made at 30-some thousand feet. So the question is, what's the story there? And there was a flip-flop in the Massawi trial, which was about, I think, in 2004 or so. And in that trial, all of a sudden, certain phone calls which were made by Barbara Olson to her husband, who was a former solicitor general, they were now no longer cell phone communications, supposedly. The FBI said they never happened. So that was, it was an inconsistency, because in the 9/11 Commission, the original report, they did happen. So we asked about that too. So you have seven areas of evidence that are very important to try and put together this crime, the crimes, what happened that day. And thus far, they've been denied us, as Mick said, for now. And that Mick's working on an appeal. And we'll be back in court on this issue.
Well, that is awesome, because you guys are pressing on all these little impasses that are what kind of keep the echoes of questions ringing in my mind, right? For me, on a personal level, I can't speak on behalf of my listeners as to what entices them about this and whether or not they even care at all. But for me personally, you touched on a few of the things that we don't have answers for, that to me just make up this kind of group of real fuzzy, you know, unanswered questions and evidence that I think in and of itself warrants a new investigation. I want to say, to go back to your point about the gentleman with the van in New Jersey photographing the Twin Towers as this was happening, I spoke about that at length, if you're a listener, with Whitney Webb on Quote the Raven 146, which is September 14th, 2019, if you want to go back and listen to what she said on that. For people that haven't listened, I want to unpack everything you just said. So for people that haven't listened, tell us just a little primer about the Dancing Israelis, as they were called, right, in New Jersey, and what you're seeking to get there and why that's important.
Well, what we've done, that's very important. And we actually did a Open Public Record Act in addition to the FOIA. The FOIA Freedom of Information Act was done at the federal level. We did a Open Public Records Act at the state level because what happened during that time, Officer DiCarlo from East Rutherford Police Department made the initial stop. State police backed him up. They found the five individuals in the truck. The truck was Urban Moving Systems,
right,
which is very suspicious front. I won't go into that, but it's very suspicious. Anyway,
go into
they
it
were,
if you want.
What's that?
I said go into it if you want.
Well, they were arrested, and they were housed for a short period of time at Giant Stadium, which is in East Rutherford. They're off of Route 3 in that area. And eventually what happened is the New Jersey State Police got the film. The FBI and them, they were cooperating. So the FBI had that New Jersey State Police develop the film. And as I said, there were 76 8x10 photographs. Now, what we did in our lawsuit against the state police, we had to do that in order in a record custodian, because we requested those photographs and they said that they didn't have them, and we didn't necessarily, we pressed them, as you said before, we're pressing to try and get to the truth. And we had to sue them, and their first record of custodian record was he was changed. They brought another guy in, and eventually they found, because they didn't look where we asked them to look, which was down in Trenton area where the forensic photography unit was, because that's what these declassified document from the FBI said, that they received these photographs from the New Jersey State Police. So we're thinking, well, maybe New Jersey should have the photographs, because a lot of your listeners may not know that New Jersey has extensive connections to 9/11. And for example, the World Trade Center buildings were owned by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and 800 New Jersey people were killed that day. That encompasses 17 of the 21 counties in New Jersey. The Flight 93 was hijacked involving Newark, New Jersey. The anthrax attacks were right where this case was being argued, down in Trenton, New Jersey, Hamilton area. And there was at least an alleged terrorist cell in Paterson, New Jersey. The steel from New York City was cut up in New Jersey and shipped overseas. So New Jersey had a connection. You would think the state police would have some record. And in particular, maybe these photos they kept because there are also individual state crimes here, not just federal crimes.
Sure, yeah.
Well, what we found out was, in contesting this, the second time in forcing them to get a new custodian of record, that he did look finally where he should have looked. And what did they find? They found a log entry. And the log entry said World Trade Center Towers bombing, terrorism, confiscated film, FBI, and the date of September 13th matched up with the date that the FBI claimed that they had their interaction with the state police, the New Jersey State Police. But on a ruling from the judge, and I won't necessarily go into that, it was we just got this ruling. They denied our appeal, so now we decided what to do. This was three judges. We appealed in front of three judges. The judge's decision, what they failed to do was to tell the judge on that log entry was an individual that she didn't know about, the initials, and they were allowed to cherry pick and give the judge the initials of the person who said he did not do the photos, he just did contact sheets. But the judge, in saying that the photos were never done, and they argued. And they actually got away with that argument at the appellate level, all right? So in other words, what we have the initials of the person who did the photographs, we think. But that person has never been identified by the attorney general in New Jersey, and the judge has even asked them, do you know whose initials this is? And they said, no. Does anyone know? No. And the set of the question is, why did you not get a statement to the court from this individual? They never asked them that. And they ruled on it without knowing who did the photos and what the disposition of those photos were, because we think they kept them, or they kept a file for them, or they're still in existence.
Right.
And at least the last thing they could say is, no, we gave them all to the FBI. We have any copies.
Right.
They could at least say that. They didn't say any of it. What the courts did is they shut the door on us. All right. And in reference to that, the whole 9/11, there wasn't anything mentioning 9/11 in our request, because I didn't mention to you there was a dog that they put through the van, and that tested positive for explosives. We also asked for those examinations, and of course we didn't receive them either.
Yeah, well, that stuff is extraordinarily important and extremely relevant. The relevance of what you're talking about, and you know, I mean, this just, it reminds me of the headline that just broke yesterday about, you know, the footage from outside of Epstein's cell has disappeared. It's been destroyed, you know, so just forget about it. It's not, you know, it's the same type of thing, right? You have the initials, you think you have the initials. Look, somebody was there. Somebody took the photographs. That we know that the photographs were taken, right? So, right. You know, those blanks need to be filled in somewhere. And in police work, as you know, it's great that you have a background in this, not only as an attorney, but as a former law enforcement official, because you understand how meticulously these things need to be documented as they take place. So what I'm guessing you guys will do is you plan on taking this to the next forum. Is that right?
Well, we have to talk. Nick and I have to talk about it, and our board does too, because this just came down. And I was surprised, actually, because I thought we carried the day in court, and I'm very dissatisfied with the judges. And I guess the next level would be the Supreme Court of New Jersey. Wouldn't that be quite, if we qualify for that and we could do that, and we'll look into that, this would be an action on those photographs you mentioned of those people that were celebrating and taking the photos. So this is a sad statement of what we are in this country right now, if you think about it. I mean, it's so many years later, but
right.
Key evidence and possible people that would have some very close information or maybe even involvement, but let's put it at this point, just say information concerning the inevitability of those crimes and being set up to take photographs of them and then being elated about what we're seeing is horror. And them eventually being allowed to leave the country, and us trying to get those photos years later when most people don't even know they exist, and us being given the runaround. In New Jersey, we were given the total runaround. We were given a direction. They did their search up in North Jersey when they know they should have done it down in the central part of New Jersey, in the Trenton area where the forensic photography unit was there. So just think this. The documents that were provided to the court and to the attorney general gave them the FBI document, which said these photos came from the forensic photography unit. They failed to look through that unit for those documents.
Right.
We had to persist, and we had to get an order in it for enhanced certifications from the judge through a hearing. And then they switched the custodian of records, brought a new guy in, And voila, he does find at least a record of those photos, but he submits then to the judge the names of only one of the people was involved and not the other. And then we bring that to the court's attention. We bring that to the attention of the appellate judges, and they just they close the case, all right? So you can wonder, in a very short decision, all right? It's a written decision of 14 pages. And which was not impressive, all right? Not impressive.
Yeah, it's, you know, I hope that you guys take it to the next forum. I don't know. I'd hate to tell you I'm optimistic about you guys getting there on this one, because obviously there's something there, right? And a lot of my listeners are financial analysts, and one of the reasons a lot of us become skeptics of companies is because we reach an impasse, we reach a point, we reach a black box, something that we can't get inside of. You know, there's a line item that we don't have a description for and a number that's being moved. And this is just one of those unknowns that you can't help but feel like there's something there. The crazy thing about this portion of what it is that you guys are looking into is that most people don't even know it exists. Most people don't know that these people were detained. They don't know that, you know, they were taking photographs. They don't know that photographs were taken of them, you know, but you're saying, here's the log entry, right? How do we get inside of that black box? And that's, it's a it's going to be a tall task. I just, you know, obviously it's already proven to be that, regardless of how swiftly the judges have not ruled in your favor, and whether or not they've considered everything that you guys wish that they would, is besides the point. But I think this is so important. I think what you guys are doing is so exceptionally important. I want to move on to the Pentagon and just talk about what my problem with the Pentagon story has been. I've looked at a lot of different theories surrounding the Pentagon, many of which I don't agree with. I've heard eyewitnesses say that, you know, it was a Gulfstream-style jet, which is your smaller, like, the kind of jet a CEO of a company would fly in. I've heard several of those statements. I've also heard several witnesses that were located around that nearby gas station say that, oh, it was definitely an American Airlines. They, you know, they saw the logo. It was definitely a commercial jet. There is a, there's definitely both sides of the argument kind of covered there in terms of that type of evidence. Without going into the fuselage measurements, the wingspan, and the light poles coming down and all that shit. The other big problem I have is we have those two cameras, right, where the footage has been released. And in there is no frame in either of those two cameras' footage of the plane hitting the Pentagon where you can identify the plane. And we all know, obviously, the Pentagon is a government building in a government area, probably one of the most, supposed to be one of the most secure areas in the world. We know that there's probably 15 ways from Sunday of video angles on where that plane hit the Pentagon, yet we get these two pieces of video from that area where the cars were driving in and out. And also, there is a fantastic documentary online called September 11th, the New Pearl Harbor, that does an analysis of the frames in those videos, where they are synced up perfectly for, I think, the first 22 frames. And then on the 23rd frame of those two videos, which are supposed to be 100% in sync, there is a major inconsistency that shows that one of the frames of the video may have been edited. So that, to me, that's a little bit down the rabbit hole. The fact that we don't have clear and concise evidence or video footage, if you want to take a step back, that to me is another reason for inquiry. Talk to me about all of this. Talk to me about what has piqued your interest in the Pentagon and which direction you're taking this.
Do you want to start, Dave, or shall I?
No, you. I just got done. Go ahead, and then I'll finish up then.
Okay. So Chris, we are initiating an investigation of the Pentagon. We don't have answers on it yet, but there are a number of pieces of evidence which I would call sort of red flags, the sort of either missing data or inconsistent data, unusual events that make you ask questions. They don't answer the questions.
Right.
But they raise the questions.
Sure.
And so in our view, those questions should have been answered already by a federal government investigation that has not been done.
Right.
So we're going to do what we can to answer those questions. Now, you know, there are a number of sort of red flags regarding the Pentagon that warrant an investigation. One of the most obvious is the very unusual and extreme flight path that Flight 77, if it was Flight 77, took to hit the Pentagon, doing this remarkable 270-degree turn and decline, simultaneous rapid decline, simultaneously, something that probably most fighter pilots would have difficulty doing, and coming in at ground level and hitting the Pentagon at ground level or near ground level. A lot of experienced pilots say that would be virtually impossible to do, and presumably impossible for a novice pilot to do, and the alleged pilot was a novice. So that's one of the red flags. You know, how did it happen? Why, if you were, you know, a terrorist trying to be successful in striking probably the most protected building in the world, arguably, you know, why wouldn't you just dive in at the first opportunity? And instead of taking this remarkable, difficult maneuver to hit the most protected, least populated portion of the building. So it's a logical, how shall I say, red flag, that it doesn't make sense. So it deserves further inquiry. There are a number of folks who've investigated the Pentagon in the truth movement, and they're not all of one mind about what happened there, just not yet. But each of them raises, I think, significant red flags and pieces of evidence that deserve further investigation. That includes whether there were explosives used at the Pentagon and whether the plane there might have been remote controlled. We haven't reached a conclusion on that. But that remarkable maneuver that is documented would have been certainly much easier to be accomplished, whoever was in the pilot seat, if it were remote controlled, than a human trying to do that. So that's why we haven't answered that question. That's why we're looking at it. There is the testimony of April Gallup that indicates, you know, in her view, explosions took place, not necessarily consistent with the official story of the aircraft strike. The initial reports of the scene in terms of the size of the initial hole before the partial collapse and also what debris was or was not visible. What you mentioned about the fact that there are all these cameras set up around the Pentagon, both government and private, we've yet to see a single clear frame. And we have a FOIA request in on that, or others we're working with do, and it's apparent that the government has a lot of videos they haven't released yet from surrounding the Pentagon, so we're trying to get those. So are there other red flags? I'll stop there and let Dave chime in.
Thanks, Mick. Yeah, there are. And there's also the first book that was put out on the Pentagon was a guy from France. I think his name is Thierry Masson. And his theory was that a missile actually hit it. And there is some evidence that from others, I'm going to say evidence, but other theories that we're aware of that a cruise missile may have been used. That was one of the theories. So what we're saying is that what Mick's saying, too, is, and you asked about the various theories, what we want to do is set up what should have been done, you know, 18, 19 years ago, a body of individuals who are going to examine the evidence, gather the evidence, develop the evidence, and the theory that applies to the evidence. And we don't have preordained what happened. And if you go into YouTube, as you said, Chris, there's all kinds of different theories. So in the Pentagon, there's a theory that there was explosions, as Mick said, pre-planted explosives. And then there's also a theory that of possible remote control. There's some people that say that it was a small commuter plane that was involved. Others say that a missile was involved. Others say there was a flyover, and there's a possibility of maybe a second plane or two planes being involved. Some planes say a big plane hit the building, and that was remote control, and then the official story is it was a big building, 77, actually hit the building. As Mick said, the flight pattern is pretty amazing for that to happen from a fellow that Hani Hanjour supposedly was not a skilled pilot and probably couldn't even pilot. But anyway,
they said he couldn't even solo a Cessna.
Yeah.
That's what his flight instructor said.
Right. So there's questions that what we want to do is gather that all that evidence and come to some kind of conclusions. Now, it may be in going to a grand jury exhibit may be from expert pilots. That'd be possible to say that's impossible. In other words, the government story is impossible because a novice pilot could not make that maneuver. It may be that all these different theories, and these theories can actually break up the 9/11 truth movement if, you know, people are too adamant and they're not tolerant to try and just sit back and let everything settle down and let's look and see if there's connections. Some of these theories could happen at the same time. There's no reason why something couldn't hit the Pentagon, there'd be bombs in the Pentagon, but that's what happened in New York City, right? That's what's claimed to happen in New York City, that there was controlled demolition, certainly, and planes hit the building. So that's two things there. It could have happened in Washington, but we're not predisposed to that. We want to see all the evidence and then, you know, put it all together. So in reference to the Pentagon, that's some of the issues. In reference to Shanksville, there's a whole lot of issues there that Mick can start.
Let's stay on the Pentagon for a second. I want to go to Shanksville. Are you guys familiar with the inconsistencies in the video that I'm talking about or no?
You mean about the frames that you can't see what hit the building?
Yeah, well, I'm talking specifically about the inconsistency between the two different cameras that appear to be 100% synchronized for the first 22 frames of the footage that's been released, and on the 23rd frame, they appear to go out of sync.
Yeah, I've heard of that, Chris, and we will examine that. In fact, if your audience has you know, input into that, and yourself even, I mean, what we're going to do is we're going to set up committees, and we're going to be getting top-notch investigators involved here. We're attorneys, and we do our investigation, but we're not skilled as a professional investigator. So that's what we would like to do. Right now, through the month of December, I don't know if you're aware of it, Ed Asner helped us. He's on our board of directors. Ed Asner's a famous actor and movie star, television star. And we were raised or trying to raise money for this investigation. So any one of your viewers that thinks this is a worthy cause, your listeners, they can mail a donation to LC, that's LC4FOR911.org, LC4FOR911.org. And they can make a contribution. But what we're doing, we want to do it real professionally. And it's so new in the sense that we're just organizing it now. In order to do what we want to do professionally, we have to raise money to be able to bring the people in that can do the job. And when we get those people together, this will be the first time it's ever done in the country. We're going to look at this, and we haven't stopped looking at New York either. Okay, right. But we're spreading out into other areas. And now there's a very, very important area that we haven't talked about yet, and that's the misconduct, government misconduct and obstruction in allowing these crimes to happen, and or in the either the complicity or the gross negligence to allow them to happen, and in the aftermath of the investigation, that there may have been government misconduct and obstruction in the investigation as to what happened, who was responsible. So that's a whole other area in addition to Pentagon and Shanksville and New York City Ground Zero.
Yeah, sure. So I wanna tell my listeners, and I wanna tell you guys as well too, to review this documentary, which I've mentioned on the podcast before. It's available on YouTube. You have to kind of go through the weeds on YouTube and type it in almost verbatim, because YouTube is indexing these things now on the second, third page. They don't, even if you type the name in perfectly, they won't give it to you. But it was made by an Italian gentleman. It's about 4 hours long, and it is the most comprehensive look at all of the things surrounding 9/11, from the exercises that were going on that day to all of the players involved. It's really an extraordinarily thorough and well done documentary, and it's very watchable too. And it's the word September. You have to type out the word September 11, a new Pearl Harbor, or the new Pearl Harbor. Try both of them. I think it's the new Pearl Harbor. But I would encourage you guys to watch it. They do the analysis of the video that I'm talking about, and they cover everything else in the 9/11 universe. Some of which I agree with, some of which I don't agree with. But if it's a topic that interests you, this 4-hour documentary is it. That is what you need.
Is that done by Mr. Masamoto?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. We're familiar with it. Well, we haven't studied it, though. We're familiar with a lot of things, but we haven't looked at it in depth. You know what I mean? And we haven't followed it up. We haven't talked to anybody to take the, say they have a witness there. We want to speak to that witness, get a statement from that witness. That witness may have other witnesses or other leads. We want to follow the leads till we sure. get to where we have to go. So we appreciate that. That was an important document. I wasn't thinking of that right now. Our important narrative by Masamoto. And we'll follow that up. Thank you, Chris.
Well, the interesting thing, too, is it touches on all of these things, you know, all the impasses that you guys have arrived at. He reviews in addition to a bunch of other stuff, but I mean, and it's so long that you can watch it several times over, and you gain new insights from it every time you watch. I encourage you guys and encourage my listeners to watch it as well, because you know, with regard to the Pentagon, again, you know, regardless of where you stand, you know, I'm not so much in the missile camp as I am, hey, just what the hell is going on? I'm not saying, hey, it was this, it was that. But when you have all this evidence, you have people that, and there's people on that documentary who, when they speak about seeing a Gulfstream style, you know, jet, a smaller business jet, and you listen to the tone in which they speak it, and you listen to the adamance with which they are giving the information, you know, it becomes very quizzical to say, well, you know, how can this person that obviously knows what a Gulfstream jet looks like and is saying that they're seeing an unlabeled plane, you know, how can that be mistaken for a silver commercial airliner with American Airlines painted on the side of it? You know, and right. Again, various other reports, other planes flying in the area. There's a million things. So I think what you guys are doing in taking a hard evidence-based look at this from the ground up, starting with... go ahead.
No, no, you're right, from the ground up. But at that day, too, there was what they call E-4B over Washington. That's a doomsday plane. That's a control plane that you could have an operation control. You can wage a war from that plane. That was right over Washington at the same time. So that's, you know, to go along with that. Now, just to mention, too, is that the repercussions is, you know, your audience might say, oh, come on, this is old stuff. What's happened? How does it affect me? You know, it's... Some people weren't even born, you know, now they're 18 years old now, 19. Right. But since that event, I like to call it the elephant in the room. There's probably a number of them that we don't see. But post 9/11, with regards to surveillance, in regards to the Fourth Amendment that protects your, you know, against searches and seizures, presently right now, at least this is from Bill Binney, who was a NSA whistleblower, that all the Americans' emails, cell phone calls, text messages, and website searches are being harvested. Totally illegal. It never happened before 9/11, but since 9/11, that kind of activity has been allowed to happen. Now, most of us don't see that. You know, we're not aware of that unless experts tell us, like Binney or Kurt Wiebe or Ed Loomis. These are guys in the NSA or whistleblowers that risk, you know, things, maybe including their lives, to bring this to the attention of the public. So that's just so people that are out there that they say, oh, come on, you know, this is a part of what's happened since 9/11. And those who were before 9/11 know that the Fourth Amendment is something to be treasured, and it's been trashed since then. All right. That's your privacy, which is having to do with the First Amendment of the Constitution. So the Constitution of the United States is really being challenged. So, in part of this is an effort to get to the truth, but it's also an effort to recover what we are as Americans, because in that Bill of Rights, it really distinguishes us from other citizens in the world. And that is, I think, the highest level of freedom thus far that human beings have been able to achieve. It's incorporated in part in that Bill of Rights. And today, that Bill of Rights, since 9/11, since the Homeland Security Act, the Patriot Act, the Indefinite Detention Act, etc., has been eviscerated.
Yeah, undoubtedly. Okay, let's take it on to Shanksville. Talk to me about what it is that you guys are seeking there and what has kind of piqued your interest.
Go ahead, Matt.
Do you want me to start, Dave? Or, okay.
Yeah, please. Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks. So, first of all, to give Dave some credit, he initiated a Pennsylvania public records request on Shanksville to the coroner's office. And he had to do an appeal on that, but eventually it was resolved by agreement that we would actually get access to the coroner's records. And Dave and I did make a couple trips and actually review the coroner's records on the Flight 93 crash site at Shanksville or near Shanksville. And that was enlightening. And to me, it raised more questions than it answered, which is why we have expanded our investigations into Shanksville as well as the Pentagon. And just like there were a number of red flags regarding the Pentagon that, you know, raised questions, the same is true in Shanksville. So I'll give you just a few of them, and then Dave can add his thoughts. One of the things we discovered in our record review that a lot of people probably don't realize hasn't really been publicized, but it may have significant implications, is that when the coroner went to identify the bodies at the Shanksville site, he could not identify most of them from the evidence at hand. And he had to do a petition to the court to get death certificates issued because of the lack of dispositive evidence on the identities. And in the process of submitting that court petition, the FBI communicated with the coroner and basically told him, do not request death certificates for the alleged hijackers because they may have been using false identities. And that issue, to my knowledge, has never been run to ground by the government. At least we haven't been told about how they ran that to ground, but it certainly was an issue that the coroner became aware of, and he documented it in one of his court filings. So to me, that is one red flag. The coroner eventually did issue, I think, identity determinations for most, if not all, the passengers of Flight 93, but had to rely on, after the fact, DNA evidence that came not from his own analysis, but from a federal government laboratory later. And that is worth, I think, a close look as well. The flight data recorder data does raise some questions itself. And there's not a consensus, I think, on the experts who have reviewed it as to what it means. That's an open area of inquiry for us. A lot of folks don't know this tidbit either, which shows why our FOIA efforts, Freedom of Information efforts, can be useful. We do have a FOIA Freedom of Information campaign going on to sort of supplement our investigative efforts. But one thing that came out of a prior FOIA that Dave Cole, one of our investigators, did with the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, was an audio recording from 9/11 of the FAA headquarters talking to various folks around the country live as things developed on 9/11. And one of the interesting things on that recording, which I've listened to, is that at one point in time, someone reports that the Secret Service has reported a crash at Camp David on 9/11, an aircraft crash. And then later in the same call, someone reports that the Secret Service has confirmed that an airplane has crashed at Camp David. Now, and that's not that far from Shanksville, and in the direction, theoretically, the plane was going towards the Capitol. There's been no, the government has sort of backed off of that, as best I can tell. They didn't publicize it to begin with, but they've later, I think, said that those reports were in error. But it raises the question to me, as a public interest lawyer, how do you get a federal law enforcement protective agency like the Secret Service, which has a certain amount of professionalism and expertise, making, first of all, a mistake about whether a plane crashed on a property that they are obligated to protect, Camp David, and then confirming that mistake, making it a second time and saying that their report of crash was confirmed.
Right.
It seems to me that the Secret Service ought to be confident enough to know whether a plane has crashed on their property. So that is an open area of inquiry for us. There are reports from folks who attended or at least one of the family members who attended a meeting with the coroner, in documents we reviewed, that indicates that aircraft wreckage parts from the cockpit were found in the trees at the Shanksville site, and also that there was basically nothing, no large pieces of anything left at the site. And that's what this family member recalled the coroner reporting in a meeting with the family members, and that raises some questions. And Dave can maybe talk a little more about this, but I don't know if I want to call them inconsistent witness reports, but there are varying witness reports about what type of aircraft were seen in the vicinity, including whether there might have been a missile fired, whether there might have been a drone witnessed, and whether an airliner might actually have been witnessed leaving, departing from the Shanksville site. So, Dave, I'll stop there and let you add your thoughts on Shanksville.
Well, thank you. First responders on the scene there, they didn't identify a crash scene. That's what they were saying. If we could talk to them, that would be good. I mean, we've seen the videos. Even Wallace Miller has the famous video where he says, not a drop of blood he's seen. He's the medical examiner. No debris that people were saying that would indicate that a plane crashed there. Now, a plane could have crashed. We don't know. We haven't done the investigation. But there are reports too that that perhaps the plane was shot down. There's, as Mick said, perhaps a plane crashed near Camp David. There's reports that there was a Predator drone involved. That the Predator drone might be what crashed at Shanksville to make that indentation, or maybe not. Maybe it is what was used to take the plane down. Suspicious is that there was Hopkins Airport in Cleveland. And apparently there's FAA reports, or there's a flight pattern that this plane indicating the plane was deep into Ohio, and that there's a claim that it actually landed in Cleveland, Ohio, and that there was two planes. One was a Delta plane, which we're not sure if that was legitimate plane or maybe even part of an exercise. That during that day, there was all kinds of vigilant exercise. In fact, a lot of the people, air traffic controllers, didn't know if it was in real time or if it was part of the exercise. It was the biggest exercise I think the United States military ever had in this country. It involved the airplanes, and that's one of the rationale where they say, well, that's why planes weren't available for Washington, even though they had advanced notice after two towers were hit and the plane was heading to Washington, and they just allowed it to come in. So you have a debris field in Shanksville of over 8,000 feet, which is significant. You have cell phone communications that experts argue couldn't be made above 8,000 feet, and yet they're being made by a number of people at high altitudes. You have questions about the one call that was made, I think, by Todd Beamer and to a person that had to do on the ground about what was happening, and yet the lion is still alive 40 minutes after the alleged crash, which would raise some questions as to what was that all about. And you have the disappearance, supposedly, of what some eyewitnesses said was 200 people going into a Nassau building on the at Hopkins Airport, and then never being seen after that. And the references that was Flight 93. You have theories of planes being swapped out. And again, remember, you have these exercises that are going on here.
Right.
And so there are so many theories out there for both the crime scenes there, the Shanksville and the Pentagon, that it's about time we get down to business to get all this evidence, and some of it may be far out, and we eliminate it. But we sort of want to bring it all in and sort of like study it and ferret out what we think is truthful or not as best we can, get professionals involved to assist us, and then construct the theories that apply to the evidence. And instead of backing into it, we want to go in full force front way by gathering this evidence and developing it. So that's some of the questions there, and just any of those areas, just the cell phone communications could be incredible. If cell phone communications were impossible at that altitude, then what are we to make of it? Now
I want to go back to the cell phones in one second, but I want to ask you about something that you said already, because cell phones are a huge point of contention with me. But I want to go back to your comment about the black box on this flight. And you said that there were some inconsistencies there, and I wanted to ask what those were. And then also I just wanted to say I was surprised to hear that they had recovered the black box from this flight, because don't we not have the black boxes from any of the flights?
We have. So, Dave, do you want to answer that?
No, you go ahead and I'll follow.
Well, they do have the let me restate this. We haven't verified what they have, so we can't say with certainty what the government has. We can tell you what they say they have. And what the government says it has, I believe at the moment, is the flight data recorder for Shanksville, Flight 93, and also the voice data recorder or remnants of it. They have a report, the government reports it has a flight data recorder for the Pentagon. And I don't believe the government admits at the moment that they have the flight data recorders for the World Trade Center planes. Now, Dave, is that consistent with your understanding?
That's as much as I would. Yeah, that's as much as I know.
Okay, so in terms of the people looking at the flight data recorders, there are experts in the truth movement looking at them, and they're not, I think, of one mind about what those flight data recorders say at the moment. I think some have concluded that there are discrepancies in the data that may make the data suspect, which may mean we can't conclude anything from it. There are some who I think their reading says that the altitude data suggests there may not have been an actual plane crash or that actual plane crashing at the Pentagon. And then there are other folks looking at that same data saying that when you get into the weeds, you can actually draw the conclusion that that data does support that plane hitting the Pentagon. And that's, of course, all assuming that this data has integrity. which we can't speak to in the moment. We haven't had a chance to examine those devices or the data from them other than what the government has chosen to give us.
Right.
So it's kind of hard. We can't reach conclusions on that, but at the moment, I don't think there's consensus even in the truth movement as to what those devices say.
And Chris, this is why, in part, what we have to do this. I mean, it's a good point, the flight data recorder, the voice recorders, are they accurate? First, do we have them, or do they match up to the flights, all right? Or have they been doctored? And, for example, in New York City, supposedly at least three of them were found. I mean, there were statements that they were found, and then they disappear, you know? So what happened there with regards to New York? In Pentagon and Shanksville, we have something tangible to work with, but we haven't had the opportunity to work that information or that evidence yet. We intend to. That's what has to be done. So you ask a good question after these years, and you have two attorneys that are pretty well-versed in this. We don't know. We want to know. We want to investigate it and put it together so that maybe next year at this time you ask us that, and we can tell you this is what we have, all right? But we can't say that now.
Yeah, didn't the mayor of Shanksville also come out and make some interesting statements the day of?
He did. He was there.
Doesn't look like there was a plane at all. Now, far be it for me to provide, any type of analysis of what happens when a commercial airliner hits soft ground at, 500 miles an hour at a, 90-degree angle or whatever it was coming down at, because that's certainly not something I feel comfortable opining on. But I found the mayor's statements interesting that day.
You're right. I've read those statements too, and he claims it didn't look like anything happened there, if I recall. As some people said, I think one of the state troopers said it looked like somebody backed up a pickup truck and threw garbage in it, a hole, basically. It wasn't a big hole. I think it was estimated 10 by 15 foot or something like that. So, yes, you have a lot of questions. Now, there was we talked to an investigator that worked at up there. They talked to a lot of people. In fact, he did the original interviews with Wallace Miller. His name was Dominic DiMaggio. So you could see the original, it used to be YouTube on there with him, with Wallace Miller, the medical examiner. And he claimed that there was people that said that they heard a plane or were aware of a plane flying over Indian Lake, which is southeast of Shanksville, which means it'd be flying away from Shanksville after alleged time when the plane supposedly crashed. So we don't know if that's the case or not, but certainly we'd like to follow that little lead up too. So there are so many different discrepancies here as to what crashed, if anything crashed, in that little hole there. Here's the problem too, and it was taken up. We know this firsthand through a medical examiner, a forensic pathologist who Wallace Miller brought in, a guy named Dr. Dirkmat. His concern was this, and our concern was too, because when we made the right to know request up to Pennsylvania, we asked for maps that would show the dispersion of the body parts or the human remains. And we got two or three little handwritten things. See, normally when an accident happens, the National Transportation Safety Bureau is involved. They do an incredibly thorough job. I looked at a plane crash in Pittsburgh where they had a report over 300 pages. But in Shanksville, because it was a terrorist-related crime, the FBI took front stage. Now, the National Transportation Safety Bureau, nevertheless, is supposed to do a report and do their study, but the FBI calls the shots at the scene. So what happened to Dirkmat is he was told basically to man a temporary morgue off the site. He was upset because normally he would do GPS triangulation of where the body parts were, so you know exactly what you're finding, where you found it, basically at what level you found it.
Right.
And so what happens is the FBI come in, they chase him away, basically. He's relegated, he says, to inventorying body parts or human remains that are brought to him late afternoon and late morning. And he's disturbed about this. Why? Because there's no chain of custody on that. And he says that disturbed him a lot. That was my understanding anyway. You have a big question there as to who was actually finding the body parts, where they found them. Is there any chain of custody on these body parts? And you have maybe we get a statement from that individual to basically verify that. Now, that has to do with in sense of the government misconduct or obstruction. if the protocols are not being adhered to, is how you investigate a crime scene. For example, the Twin Towers, or the, you know, New York City. The protocol there is to check for explosives and bombs in an incident like that. And you have to check the metal. You have to secure the iron, steel, the girders, and have your forensic people go in there, do their tests, and take their photographs, etc. Take your samples. That was done. It was all shipped out as soon as they could and taken overseas. Now, is that inappropriate? Is that the protocol to do that in this kind of crime? And, you know, so little things, but things like that may add up to so many of them, you're just going to say, holy mackerels, you know. But we can't right now. We just have to, you know, do the gather the evidence, bring the experts in, see what should have been done and what compared to what was done.
Yeah, I think it's really important that you guys are doing it from the ground up, because if you buy the government story, which is fine, you know, a ground up approach should arrive at the same conclusion. You guys should be able to follow the breadcrumbs and arrive at the same conclusion if that's what really happened, doing it from the ground up in the same manner that if NIST was told, here's what happened, make these pieces fit, they backed themselves into it. And I'm not saying that that happened, but I'm saying if what the government contends is the truth and what we're being told is the truth, any way that you want to arrive there, you should be arriving there, especially if you're going to be going at it in a clinical fashion like you guys are. You know, and this is why I think what you guys are doing is so important, because you kind of have this legal angle to it covered. So you guys aren't a couple of, you know, astrologists or conspiracy theorists out in some shack somewhere wearing tinfoil hats. I mean, you guys are professionals. You're obviously professional attorneys. You know, you have a pedigree, you have a credibility, you have law enforcement experience. You're not going to be out there waving bullshit nonsense and asking people to follow leads that don't have any substance behind them, because in a court of law, that's not going to hold up. In a court of law, you need cold, hard facts. And that's why I think the way that you guys are doing this is so exceptionally important. If it's okay with you, I'd like to go on and talk for a second about the cell phone calls. It's something that you brought up at the beginning of the podcast, and again a second ago. This has always been one of the many points that has always just stuck with me. Some calls were made from air phones on 9/11, which are the phones that are connected, you know, through the plane. And other phones had been confirmed to, other phone calls were confirmed to have been made from passenger cellular telephones. Now, the interesting thing is, if you fly regularly, and I do, it's 2020 now, and everybody knows what happens when you get on a flight. You are on the runway, your phone works, you take off, the aircraft begins its ascent, and at some point during the ascent, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 feet into the air, whatever it is, your phone goes to zero bars, and then you start to pray that the flight that you're on has Wi-Fi, if you're me. And never have I been able to make a call, or never have I started to get all my incoming data that kind of queues up during the middle of a call, at a point where I was waiting to land, like on approach, or at a point where I had, you know, was after the initial takeoff, maybe after a couple minutes of climbing. Because during the flight, you're at 15, 20, 25, 30,000 feet. And as we all know, even now in 2020, that just doesn't happen. So the question is, how do people make phone calls, cell phone calls, that show up on phone records as coming from people's cell phones, or show up on people's caller ID as coming from their cell phones, while these planes are ostensibly in the air? Not in 2020, but in 2001. So you think about the little piece of shit Nokia phone that you were using in 2001. Okay, I was a senior in high school at the time. I mean, it was a one piece with a black and white screen. How are those calls being made? What kind of mental gymnastics do you need to do to say, oh, this flight was at such and such an altitude that this person made this call, and the calls that we have recordings of, like the CC Lyles call, which actually I think may have been an airphone call, but they all come in pretty clear. Talk to me about what piques your interest about these cell phone calls.
So, Dave, shall I start?
Yeah, you can start. Yeah, sure, Mick.
So, Chris, I think this is one of those red flag things that, you know, draws the attention of folks who are trying to make sense out of what happened, because it appears on its face to be highly irregular that, you know, phone calls could be made with cell phones as reported at altitudes as reported in the official story, when the technology at the time either wouldn't allow those calls to happen or wouldn't allow them to happen and be maintained for any length of time. In other words, they would be cut off shortly after, even if they did connect.
Because you're passing through towers. There's towers every, like, you know, 5-6 miles or whatever it is. So the call would ostensibly be dropped at the rate of speed that you're moving several times. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
That's okay. And I think the technology may have improved at this point in time. But back then, I think there was a general consensus that these calls, if not impossible to have been made at the altitude reported, would have been highly unlikely to have been able to be made for the length of time reported.
Sure.
So then that, you know, raises the question, what are the potential explanations for this apparent irregularity or discrepancy? And to me, and we haven't answered this, of course, we're investigating it, but to me, there are three potential answers. One is potentially that something unusual and unexpected happened, that the calls actually got through notwithstanding the limits of the technology at that time. In other words, it was a highly improbable event based on technological feasibility, and it just coincidentally happened on 9/11. Now, another explanation is that the calls weren't made as reported, and that, you know, either someone falsely reported the calls or someone fabricated the calls. That's one theory out there, and we have not adopted it, but it's out there. And a third theory is that, which I think deserves a close look, is that the calls were authentic. In other words, they were made by the people reported, but the reason they were made and not interrupted more than they were is because the planes on which they were making the calls from were actually at a lower altitude than reported at the time.
Right.
And then that raises quite questions about how could that happen and why did it happen? And also questions about what the radar was showing. So, and those are important questions. And if we get to the bottom of those, we, you know, we may actually get some kind of a breakthrough.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, in reference to what Mick said, the David Ray Griffin, he's a professor of religion. He's very well known in the 9/11 movement. He's like sort of the dean. He's written about 10 to 12 books. And one of the areas that he talked about was morphology. He has, I believe, an expert in his book that talks about voice morphing. In other words, Chris, if I have this certain kind of technology, I can take your voice, listen to it for just a minute, record it, and then put it in like to a synthesizer or to a machine and call your friend up and have you say whatever I want you to say, and he will think it's you, but it's really me. Now, we realizing too that, again, we know that there was reports of cell phones. What to make of it, we haven't studied yet. But one of the possibilities that is out there is that they were morphed voices. They weren't the real people. Now, in putting in the context of what was going on there, we have these war games going on at the same time. What Mick said is that a plane could, at a lower altitude, you probably could make a cell phone communication. If you were landed, you probably can make a cell phone communication too. If you were involved in an exercise, you may be making a communication you're not even aware of that is being used for a crime. So there's that possibility. So with regards to the cell phone communications, it's a very interesting area. It doesn't seem possible, as you said, especially in 2001, that these calls, if the government had originally documented them, could have been made. In reference to the call that Barbara Olson made to her husband, he claimed originally there was cell phone communication. I believe he said he read her number came up, all right? Later on, he was told that that didn't happen and that there was no connection, or it was a zero-second connection. So here's the former Solicitor General, and now the FBI is basically changing his statement. I don't know. I mean, we may want to follow that up. I don't know if we follow it up with him, or certainly we'll follow it up. So it's just that there's still a lot of questions to be answered in reference to the cell phone communications, but it is an area that definitely needs to be researched and investigated.
Yeah, definitely. That's one of those areas that presents a question that I just haven't gotten a satisfactory answer to. It doesn't mean that there isn't one out there. It just means that, you know, there's these certain spots to poke at, and this is one of them. And, you know, the other, have you heard the CeCe Lyles phone call where, you know, she whispers something at the end of the call?
Definitely have. And it sounds like, what was it? It's a fake or something like
it's
that.
It's a fake or it's a frame or something. Yeah. My question is, without even going into that, you know, why can't we have that analyzed by a linguist and figure out what the hell it is she's saying there?
Well, maybe we can. All right. Maybe we can. Maybe that's where we'll end up. And that'll be conclusion of the lawyers committee that we need to bring another expert in. That's why we need to raise money to bring these people in that can do that. They're not going to necessarily do it for free, although it would be nice.
Right, right. Of course not. But I mean, it's things like that, because that's one of these points, like the voice morphing you're talking about. You know, it's one of these points that I would only want to get to and bring up after we have built a case as to why we should be examining it. You know, voice morphing is it, you know, possible that it could have happened in 2001? Yes, we know about deepfake videos and deepfake audio. But to me, it always seems like starting at the simplest point and the base kind of foundational level zero, i.e., how were these calls made? You know, in what order and at what altitude were these planes reported to be at the time that they were called? Which ones were made from air phones? Which ones were made from cellular telephones, i.e. your cell phone? And let's get that explanation first. And then from there, you know, go out and start to examine all of these other things.
Right. Well, that cell phone communications, that technology is similar to me in looking at it, because thinking back then, this is a novel technology. And certainly in voice morphing, people have really not even heard about, probably, unless you were in the intelligence area. But the remote control is similar, too, that you could actually control hijack a plane from the ground. You can actually shut the pilot out of his controls so he can't control the plane. And you could also set it up so that he couldn't communicate.
Right.
At least that's my understanding. So that's one possibility of actually hijacking a plane that was wired. My understanding is that those are Boeing planes, both the United and American, I believe, airlines were wired with that possibility. Lufthansa at one time, they were going to wire, it was wired, and they had it all stripped out because they didn't want a ground control to be able to do that. So in some regards, it might be good, because you would say, well, if it was hijacked by bad guys, we could land it and they can't crash it. But at the same time, if it's being manned from the ground by bad guys, or, you know, they could actually do something. That's one of the theories that's out there as far as remote control, and it could be applied to the planes in all the crime scenes. It could be. I'm not saying if it is, you know, I have the slightest idea, but it certainly is something to look at.
Yeah, it's my understanding that those planes did have that technology as well. That's another thing. You know, if the evidence leads us there, it would definitely, I think, be worth considering. I think there's a base level of evidence that needs to be assembled and a base level of conclusions that need to be drawn first that I think will lead us in the direction of kind of what we should look at after that, which is why, again, I think what you guys are doing is so important. I just have a couple more questions for you. I'm going to let you guys go. I appreciate your time very much. When I think about pieces of relatively hard evidence that I think have been ignored, I think about the gentleman that was working in the sub-basement, I believe his name was Rodriguez, the janitor of one of the World Trade Centers. And I'm wondering if you guys have looked into his statements publicly, and I actually believe that he speaks about it. I think he actually, he goes out and he gives speeches about, you know, the explosions that he claims he heard from under him, I believe, before the planes hit the tower. He was in, I think, sub-basement one. I think there's several sub-basements. Are you familiar with who I'm talking about and what he has said?
Yeah, we're both familiar with him. In fact, some statements or his references in the petition. Mick, you may want to talk about him, and I'll follow it up with just something to say.
Well, I think we're probably going to say the same thing, but you're talking about Willie Rodriguez, and he did report explosions, I think, including prior to the plane strike, in the lower level of one of the towers. And there is other evidence that corroborates what he's saying. We haven't received a statement yet from Willie in terms of an affidavit or declaration or oath, but his public statements are as you described. And other witnesses have reported similar explosions. And we do, in our petition to the U.S. Attorney in New York for the grand jury, report some expert analysis on the seismic evidence, which indicates that there were explosions prior to the plane strikes, which would be consistent with Mr. Rodriguez's testimony.
And if you have seismic evidence, right, which shows that explosions took place before the plane hit the tower, and you can prove that, there's seismic evidence that something shook the earth at this spot prior to the plane hitting the building, everything goes out the window. Everything.
Well, we have that, Chris. That's in the petition. Dr. Rousseau, who did that, the seismic reports, the analysis, it shows that there was explosions before the plane hit in the lower part, in the basement area, and also right before the towers came down, there was explosions.
Right.
So we have that. That's just one of the exhibits. So I'm telling you, is that these exhibits are dispositive of controlled demolition, and that is one of the articles that we're using to prove that just one of them. But in reference to Willie Rodriguez, you're right, he was down in the lower one of the basements. There's, my understanding, six basements, and I think he was the first one down. Massive explosion there. A guy comes running into his office there with his skin hanging off his arm and his face. Willie took him out and got him out of there, saved his life. He had a master key to the North Tower, and he helped save probably hundreds of people, and he got awarded for that later on. He was probably the last one out of the building of the North Tower, Building 1, and dove under a fire truck, which was covered with debris, and he was under there for a while. Fortunately, people saw, I think, it happened, and they dug him out. A very brave man. My understanding is in New Jersey. We would love to talk to Willie. You know, and he's not the easiest guy to get in touch with, but he's a very important witness. And he witnessed explosions in the basement prior to the plane hitting. Not only him, others witnessed the same thing.
And that would be corroborated by the seismic evidence. So right there you would have, in a courtroom, two pieces of primary source firsthand evidence.
That's right. Yep.
I mean, and you just have to think about that, right? If that can be proven, if it can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt that explosions took place at the towers before the planes hit them, right?
Well, what has to happen now, Chris, just now, we've given all this evidence to the U.S. attorney. No, normally the FBI would be gathering this evidence, right? It's been gathered thanks to architects and engineers and to our organization and other good scientists. And we've given it to them. They don't have to do anything more than present it to an objective body, a grand jury, 16
right.
to 23 people, to look at the evidence, view it, connect the dots, and start demanding investigators to follow it up and then get some indictments here if they possibly could. But certainly the evidence is there to present. So the question is, why isn't the U.S. attorney presenting the evidence? And as Mick said, we're suing them to push this issue to the forefront, because we want even an acknowledgement that they're going forward, or we want the judge to order them to go forward, one or the other. And I can't underestimate this terrible crime, that somehow we put in the back mirror somehow and, you know, go forward in the future, because everything moves so quick nowadays, we don't have time to reflect. But if we don't reflect on this crime, we can lose our country very easily. And lose the value of our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and do things that are abhorrent And we're allowing this to happen to our own citizens, 3,000 citizens massacred on that day, a crime that's not been addressed, not been looked at all. You have a group of people that have assembled valuable information and evidence that should be presented and considered. And you have, for the most part, the news media not covering the issue either. So you have a major problem here. This transcends maybe anything we've experienced as Americans thus far, because the concentration of power is so great. And we want to just to get a fair shake here, get the evidence out in the public, and let the U.S. attorney do his job, present it to the American people through the grand jury.
You know, one of the things I tell Richard Gage when I have him on, and one of the, you know, my thought process on this is as follows, right? Sorry for my listeners, because this will be redundant, but in conversation with you guys, I want to say this, that Building 7 was one of the things that drew me to this skeptical position, because I remember clearly on that day, I remember watching the news reports, I remember where I was on 9/11, I remember we were watching Fox News, I remember news reports specifically giving the indication that that building was definitely going to come down. There was an air of expectation that that building was going to fall as it grew later and later into the day. And I remember they had a little graphic of Osama bin Laden's face pasted on the screen by the afternoon in different mainstream media channels. Some were spelling it with an O. Some, I think Fox News was spelling it with a U, Usama at the time. I remember the details pretty well of that day. And as I've thought about this in, you know, the past two decades, and I've watched all these documentaries and I've read all these reports and everything else, you know, I've tried to kind of channel the feeling of that day. And I keep arriving back at this, that there was this air of expectation that 7 was going to come down. And when I look at the way that it did come down, and I've worked with people that have worked with steel, I've worked with fabricators, I've worked with welders, I've worked at a chemical plant that uses processes that uses steel. And I think about, you know, obviously I'm not an engineer, I'm not a physicist, okay? But I feel like I have my head screwed on straight. And to me, with 7, there was always this kind of preponderance of the evidence that led me to think that maybe this story isn't what we were told on 7. And from there, I always thought, if we can just, I say 7's the key to unlock the door. If we can disprove 7, which I think is the easiest route, the point of least resistance. Now, after hearing this seismic stuff, I think maybe differently. But if we can find that and we can get undeniable, unequivocal proof, the door swings open to ask questions about everything else. And that's why, speaking with you about this Willie Rodriguez thing and the seismic evidence of an explosion before, because there's no real world explanation. There's no, you know, there's no explanation that would fit the narrative of the government, or that would fit the narrative of what we've been told as to why there would be an explosion in the building prior to the plane hitting it. It just should have been business as usual in the building prior to that. So I think you guys are doing such important work, because I think if you arrive at one of these indisputable conclusions and you can flip the fucking switch in the other direction, that turns on all of the rest of the circuitry and allows people to ask questions about everything else.
Chris, for your audience, in case they don't know it, Building 7 was the third tower that collapsed that day. It was only covered on that day. It was hardly mentioned at all after that. This wasn't just any building. It was 610 feet high, 48 stories. It would have been at that time the biggest building in 33 states, was not hit by an airplane. And the NIST, when the National Institute of Standards and Technology did the initial reports, they left out a very important thing with physicist David Chandler found out in doing the calculations, that there was for 2.3 seconds pre-fall in the building for over 100 feet. And when he brought that back to NIST's attention, they corrected the report, but they could not explain the free fall. That means that everything is taken out below it. All the columns and numerous columns had to be taken out. And the only way you can explain the free fall is that there was controlled demolition there. Now, controlled demolition takes weeks, if not months, to set up, especially that type of perfect controlled demolition where it comes down in its own footprint. So you're right. Building 7 and architects and engineers harp on it. That certainly is a smoking gun now that has not ever been explained, even by the NIST people that were set up to explain it. They can't explain the free fall based on the hypothesis they had as the office fires brought the building down. However, it could be understood very easily if you add a different hypothesis. Was there controlled demolition involved? If you ask that question, then the answer is easy, yes, because there's free fall involved in the building.
Yeah, so I think what you guys are doing, I really, to be honest with you, I didn't know what to expect from this interview because I hadn't heard of you guys. And I hope you don't take that as a diss. And you guys solicited me to come on the podcast, which usually is an automatic no, because I like to pick and choose my guests. The topic is certainly interesting to me. I know it's interesting to a lot of my listeners. I looked at your website prior to coming on. You know, it doesn't look especially fantastic, and I didn't really know what to get, but I can't say enough that I think you guys are absolutely the people that we need doing exactly what you're doing. And the best part is, not only, you know, here's the interesting thing, man. When I think about people that get upset over this, and every time I do one of these 9/11 podcasts, I get another email. I'm sure I'll get one today. You know, with abhorrent, awful things that people say to me. But what you guys are doing is what you guys are doing. And the worst outcome for the United States, or for the people rather that don't agree with that there should be an alternative investigation or a new investigation, the worst outcome for them is, you know, there's a new investigation that goes and proves everything that we're supposedly already know. There's no downside. You know, you're not out there sucking up taxpayer money. You're not sucking up government resources. You're not out there causing a public disturbance. You're not, you know, you guys are professionals and you're doing this the right way. And I think we stand, I think the risk reward, as we would say in investing, is asymmetric. I think we stand to gain an immense amount from the effort that you guys have put forth. I think asking these types of questions and doing that in the clinical manner that you're doing, I think those answers, even if they're the exact ones that the government has already been provided to us, I think that we're owed those answers anyways from our government. And I just can't thank you guys enough. I think this is the definition of patriotism, and I'm immensely grateful that you guys took the time to come on my show, and I would love for you guys to come back on at some point.
Well, thank you, Chris, for having us on. We appreciate that, and we'd love to come back at a later time and report back to the American people and yourself. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you guys so much, and we'll speak soon, hopefully.
Great.
All bye-bye. Right. Take care. Fantastic interview. That was David Maeswinkel and Mick Harrison. Just absolutely fascinating. And I'm really stoked that these guys are doing what they were doing. I was going to hold on to this podcast and not release it today. Which is why I didn't say the date at the beginning of it, because I just did Whitney Webb's podcast yesterday and I thought maybe I'd let that one sink in. But I have to put this one out there today. Today's Friday, January 10th, 2020. And let's get this shit out there on the internet, on the air, immediately, because you guys need some shit to fester in your head for the weekend. So I want to thank those gentlemen very much for coming on. Again, people that make this podcast possible, if you enjoy it, are my patrons, people that sign up through Patreon. If you enjoy the podcast, I would encourage you to do that. I genuinely appreciate it. And I sincerely hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Peace!